and three nights. You did not look bad as some, but you had such a fever, I was afraid you would die. I tried to part my lips and smile to show her that I was far from dead, that I didn't want to die. Odette and Wilner had already died for me. "Do you have a place to go now?" she asked. I shook my head no. "Can you speak?" she asked. "No." She motioned for me to open my mouth. I felt my face splitting apart as I did. "What of the man who came, washed, and dressed you as you suffered through the worst of your fever?" "Who?" I raised my eyebrows to ask. "It must be someone you know." I felt the large veins in my neck rise, the air catching in large bubbles in my throat. "His name is Sebastian Onius."
"He said his name was Eve," she remembered.
Eve came to see me what must have been a few days later. I wanted to thank him for caring for me during my fever. But how? He looked better now, except for shreds of gauze taped in odd shapes on different sections of his head. His hair had grown in tufts around the gauze. He saw me staring at the tufts and said, "I can't yet shave my head." I wanted to tell him that he looked well. He didn't need to have his head shaved. He seemed to be healing. "I sleep outside with the moon," he said. "It's good unless it rains." "Good, good," I nodded. "I've been looking every place I can for Sebastian and Mimi." I could tell from the suddenly much graver expression on his face that he thought I was looking too hopeful. "The priest and the bishop try to question people and take their names. I have asked them about Sebastian and Mimi." "And now?" I raised my shoulders to ask. "Nothing," he said. "Nothing at all. Maybe they passed through another border post. Maybe they were well enough to go directly to their mother's house." In spite of my own wishes, I felt myself sliding back towards sleep. It was either cry or sleep. That's all my body seemed to be able to do. His visits were like one conversation carried out over many days. Some of them I remembered, and others I didn't. "I'm going back to my land tomorrow," he said when he came another time. A little more hair had grown around his bandages, which were smaller now. "Tell me with a nod if you would like to come with me." I tried to say yes, I would go with him. I would go with him wherever his home was, try to forget everything that had taken place on the journey, and wait for Mimi and Sebastian to return. "Good," he said. "We will let you sleep tonight, and I will come for you tomorrow." It rained all that night, and most of the people who were sleeping outside came running inside. The shutters above me were opened, letting a steady drizzle into the room. Someone finally woke up to close them, but by then I was drenched. Eve made his way towards me and sat in the dark, with his back against a wooden beam nearby. "I will take you to Sebastian's house," he said, "where you can sit with him and Mimi and his mother and talk about all this like a bad dream." "How long now since we have been here?" My throat felt like it was tearing from the effort of trying to speak. "6 days," he said. "What did I do when I had the fever?" I asked.
"Sleep and wake again and again," he said, "but mostly sleep."
"And you have been caring for me?" He nodded. "With the rain, the river will overflow," I said, "and if Mimi and Sebastian are crossing, it will not be good."
"They say the killing has stopped," he said.
"There is a dream I have often," I said. of my parents in the river, in the rain.
Sebastian told me more than once about it, he said.
Someone shouted from the other side of the room. It was the man who had woken up in the cadaver pit. He said he heard his woman calling him from the river, and he wanted to go save her. While Eve and a few other men restrained him, the nuns awoke from their sleep and forced him to swallow a few spoonfuls of a syrup that, along with his grief, made him suckle his thumb and cradle his body like an infant for the rest of the night. The next morning, Eve went along with the priests, the doctors, and the others whose work it was to collect corpses along the riverbank. Their work took the whole morning, even though the nuns too told us that the killing had ceased, and there were hardly any more corpses to bury. The room was full beyond its measure now, with everyone seeking shelter from the mud outside. I looked for my face in the tin ceiling above me as I waited for Eve to return. With everyone lying face up, and with their bodies so close together, I couldn't tell which face was mine. The man from the cadaver pit lay on his mat all morning, mumbling his woman's name. Nunun! Nunun! Next to him was a crippled Dominican who could console him only in Spanish. Calmate, hombre, mumbled the Dominican. He was black like the nun who came to redress his wounds. He'd been mistaken for one of us and had received a machete blow across the back of his neck for it. There were many like him in the room, I was told.
31. The sky was smeared with gray, gray like the inside of a broiled fish, when Eve and I finally left the clinic in Camion one afternoon. In that part of the country, the indigo mountains, cactus trees, large egrets and flamingos were great spectacles for the eyes, visions that made the people feel obligated to twist and contort their hurt bodies, to peer outside and shiver with gratitude for having survived to see their native land. Eve and I were pressed into a corner near the back of a crammed row. I knew my knee was pressing into his side, but I could find no room to shift into. Eve had not found Mimi and Sebastian that morning, and for this he was regretful. For this he was silent, watching his own twirling fingers with downcast eyes and grimacing, but not complaining each time my knee rammed into his side during a sudden stop. Perhaps he thought I hated him and was tormenting him for being there instead of Sebastian. Maybe he even thought that he deserved some kind of punishment for not being his friend. The cap was still in the old New City when we returned to it, a city burned to the ground many times for its own salvation. These were tales that all the local children knew, for proof was sometimes found buried in their land, a gold coin, a silver saucer, which the ground would vomit up when it rained, like the bones of those laid to rest without caskets in shallow ground. The dream was to find a jar, a chest full of gold that a French plantation owner had buried along with the slaves he had killed and interred next to it so the slaves' souls could be the guardians of the treasure. To the French generals who returned in fleets to reclaim these treasures and the souls of their slaves, Henri I had said, I will not surrender the cap until it's in ashes, and even then I will continue to fight on these ashes. He had given the signal to start the fires by torching his own house first. The houses that were now built along the Place Toussaint-Louverture, under a statue of Toussaint, where the Camion left us, the houses of the cap were now less grand, two stories at best, with wooden railings, double doors, and galleries on top. Not like the old vast plantations that were meant to last for centuries. As soon as we descended from the camion, Eve parted from all the others. I followed him, looking up and searching the sky. The giant citadel, Henri de Furce's treasure, was leaning down towards the city from inside a wreath of sun-filled clouds. I wondered if Eve thought about such things, or if he even noticed what was inside the shops as we ventured along the cleanly paved streets, among small groups of men and women, ambling past the shoe and fabric shops on the Rue du Quai. I was trailing far behind him with my face to the skies, trying to ignore the throbbing in my knees. The small bones of my bare feet were grating each other raw. Every movement required a pause, a thought to what I was doing, where my legs were going as opposed to where they were supposed to be. Some of the merchants and shopkeepers and their workers moaned as we moved among them. They recognized us without knowing us. We were those people. They nearly did. The ones who had escaped from the other side of the river. I dragged my feet along, feeling now and then like other people were standing on them, people whose eyes were only a flutter away from mine, whose hands and fingers wandered freely towards me, whose lips shouted, "Pujab," poor devil, in my ear.
"Come, come,"
Eve called, as we walked past the trellised doors of the old Hotel New York, and in past a sidewalk where someone was demonstrating the use of a phonograph and a sewing machine from a shop on La Rue A. Eve seemed to be searching for some place to enter while walking in circles as if he was lost and didn't even know it. On La Rue B, he stood in the middle of an open tourist market, scratching the scabs on his unshaven head as he waited for me to catch up. When I reached him, he asked me to stand there, holding on to the front post of a pharmacy as he ran inside and bought a pack of La Nationale cigarettes. He smoked nearly the whole pack by the time we reached the cathedral. In front of the cathedral, a woman moved so close to me that I could smell the chewing tobacco on her breath, the sweat that dried and then poured out again from her forehead, and the bitter thick-skinned oranges piled in a basket standing by itself on her head. Without looking where her hand was going, she reached up and pulled an orange from the basket and gave it to me. "You warm this orange on an open fire," she said. "Let it burn until the skin turns black." "I thank you," I said. "I am not finished," she said. "When the skin turns all black, you know it is ready. Then you cut it open while the juice is still hot. Slap the insides against your flesh. Then you take a warm bath and wash the orange flesh away. All your cuts will heal. Your bone aching will stop." I grasped the orange tightly so it would not fall. She walked behind me, then gave another orange and the same commands to someone else. Eve was now keeping pace beside me. A few people recognized him as we walked down a gravel road, away from the commercial area. A man with a pile of embroidered tourist shirts on his arm followed us and announced to the people living in the small crowded limestone houses along the gravel road, "It's Ma Rapadou's boy, Eve! He's returned from over there." The man poked his hand out from underneath the heap of shirts he was carrying and gave Eve a joyous handshake. "It didn't take you, eh?" he said. "They couldn't take you. No more than the Yankees could take me." The man with the tourist shirts talked endlessly about events that had taken place since Eve had left, how the Yankees had gone back to their country 3 years before, how Eve's mother was well, though always heart-crushed, anxious for him. The house was one of many constructed from mismatched pieces of timber and rusting tin. Eve leaped towards a low step that led to his mother's front door. A large woman was standing on the doorstep, struggling to push her arms through the short sleeves of her rainbow-striped blouse. Her fingers were snarled in the fabric, and she tore at it fiercely to free herself. Her chest was bare, the skin of her breasts the color of molasses. She was about to step into the road without the blouse when Eve jumped in front of her. He guided her clenched fists through the sleeves and calmly buttoned the blouse for her. She watched as he did this and rocked herself all the while saying his name. When he was done, she grabbed his head and pressed it against her neck, then wept into the scabs on his scalp. The woman did not see me standing there on the edge of a growing crowd of curious onlookers. I spun the orange in my hand and tried not to squeeze it too hard from anxiety.
"Man, Rapadou, you're so happy to see your son, no?"
said the man with the pile of tourist shirts in his arms. Eve walked over, took my hand, and brought me out of the crowd.
"You have a woman? This is your woman?"
his mother asked.
"Don't be so rash, man, Rapadou,"
Eve said. The mother opened her arms and nodded her head, beckoning to me. I wasn't certain how to respond, so I stood there next to Eve, pretending I didn't understand what she'd said. She yanked my hand and pulled me into her arms. The gathering of observers laughed. The mother waved them off with a turn of her face.
"Her name is Amabel," Eve said.
Hearing him say it, listening to the mother repeat it, made me feel welcomed.
"Inside now,"
the mother said, waving goodbye to the onlookers. She was wearing one shoe on her foot. The other she had left inside in her haste to run out and greet her son. We were in the first room of the house. The back room led to a courtyard shared among many families. It reminded me of the compound at Don Carlos's mill. Eve went out to greet his relations who lived around the courtyard. They brought a chair out for him to sit in beneath a tree in the middle of the yard, a tall, vibrantly green traveler's tree, with the palmetto branches spread out like the fingers on a hand. The mother served us a hot cup of salted coffee. The inside of my mouth was scalded as I sipped, but I struggled not to spit it out, because the taste of salt washed out the taint of parsley and blood that had been on my tongue since the beating at the square. Eve's relations from the yard put together and cooked a large meal for him. They fried and stewed all his favorite foods, goat meat and eggplants, watercress and codfish sauce, corn mush, and black beans. Eve ate everything placed in front of him. Now and again, his mother would interrupt his eating to tell a story about how much he had eaten as a boy, not only fruit and sweets, but also moist dirt from bean plant roots, which he liked to rub against his gums until they bled. Eve stopped to listen to his mother's stories, as though he too was hearing them for the first time. The mother was telling her tales, I realized, to stop him from eating too quickly, to force him to rest his mouth and stomach.
"Remember a man who was put in prison?"
The mother stood in a corner rubbing her large belly.
"After nothing but bread and water for 30 days, they let him out of prison and he brought himself home. First thing I do is cook him all the rich food he had dreams about in prison. He ate until he fell over on his plate in the middle of eating.
He died eating," she told the relations with a deep, long laugh.
"Please, don't kill my son. A man can die of hunger, but a man can also die over a plate of food."
Eve put his spoon down and pushed his plate away. His mother chortled, even though no one was cackling along with her. She seemed to be the only one who could laugh out of sadness, a sadness that made the laughter deeper and louder still, like the echo of a scream from the bottom of a well. The mother stroked her hairy chin with her long, thick fingers, still laughing. She reminded me of the old women at the cane mill with their cheeks split in half. The flesh healed because it had to. but never sealed in the same way again. I remembered what my father used to say, as he would hurry off with a knapsack of bottles filled with leaves and warm rum, as he raced to a birth or to a death, thinking of ways to encourage or halt the event.
Misery won't touch you, gentle. It always leaves its thumbprints on you. Sometimes it leaves them for others to see, sometimes for nobody but you to know of.
The mother looked like she had her own share of misery. The only thing it hadn't touched was a mouth full of perfect white teeth, curved like the round edges of an enamel cup, none of them her own. My own mouth was still too bruised for hard foods. A full plate of fried goat meat remained on my lap. Eve's mother walked over to me and asked, "Some soup for you. It won't be too hot or too thick." She took the full plate from my lap and came back with a small bowl of pumpkin soup. While the others watched, she fed me the soup with a tiny spoon, as though I were a sick, bedridden child.
32.
That night, the mother moved six cousins out of the second room so Eve could share his old bed with me. The bed was made from four posts mortar to the ground, and a wooden platform that held a small mattress filled with old rags. The room where Eve's mother slept was separated from ours, only by a rattling beaded curtain. When she went to bed, he followed her there. I sat alone on a new bed and played with my bitter orange while listening to the noises from outside. Everything the people who lived around the courtyard said or did could be heard. Their caresses and arguments, their gossip, and the cries of their restless children.
"Who is this woman?"
the mother asked Eve. "Where are her people? Are they here, or did they all die in the killing over there?" Eve said nothing. I went out to the yard, found a cooking fire and a basin of water, bathed myself with the bitter ange the way the woman in front of the cathedral had instructed. I could hear some of the courtyard children giggling as they peered at me through the holes in their doorways. In spite of their curiosity, I knew that my body could no longer be a tempting spectacle, nor would I ever be truly young or beautiful, if ever I had been. Now my flesh was simply a map of scars and bruises, a marred testament. Eve was still with his mother when I came back to bed. They had moved on to talking about other things unfamiliar to me, about old friends who had died or moved to other parts of the country, about his father's land, which had not been cultivated since Eve left. Each time I closed my eyes, I saw the river and imagined Sebastian and Mimi drowning the way my mother and father and Odette had. To escape these thoughts, I envisioned Henri de Furce's citadel as I had seen it again that afternoon, its closeness to the sky, its distance from the river. With my childhood visions of being inside of it, protected, I fell asleep. The next morning, I stumbled out of bed, ashamed to have slept so soundly and so late. The mother was sitting under the traveler's tree outside, pouring steaming hot water over the powdered grains in her coffee pouch. "Where's Eve?" I asked. I didn't even know if he had come and lain in the bed with me the night before. "He's on his father's land," the mother said. "He comes out of bed this morning and says he wants to go and plant some beans in his father's fields." I didn't know what Eve had told her about me. She got up, walked towards me, clasped my face between her wet hands, and planted a kiss on my forehead. "You call me Mom Rapadou," she said. "I know your story." Which story of mine did she know? Which story was she taught? "Everything you knew before the slaughter is lost.
she said. Perhaps she was encouraging me to embrace her son and forsake Sebastian. Even my memories of him, those images of him that would float through my head repeatedly, like brief glimpses of the same dream. Eve stayed in the fields until nightfall. When he came home, his hands were coated with mud and he smelled like the earth had been turned inside out over him. I planted a field of green beans, he announced to his mother. I told you, it is not the season, she said.
We'll see, he said.
When will you pay a visit to Mandenise? His mother asked. He did not answer. It is only respectful that you go and visit with her since you and her son left here together, she said. Eve walked out to the courtyard to wash himself. I went back to our room and lay down on the bed, hoping to fall asleep before he returned. When he came in and called my name, I did not answer. He lay down and curled himself up on his side of the mattress. He did not speak in his sleep that night, or any other night after that. While Eve was in the fields the next day and his mother was visiting a friend, I asked some of his relations and found out where Mandenise, Sebastian and Mimi's mother lived. I made the promise of a mint confection to a boy who took me there. The house was not too far from Eve's, but was in a less populated area, with bigger residences and more trees. I walked back and forth around the property. There was no activity, except for a girl rushing in and out of the yard, carrying jugs of water on her head.
The woman who lives there, she will not come outside,
the boy with me said. Do you want to go inside and speak with her?
No,
I said. What would be the use? She hadn't known me when her children were still hers alone, safe in her house. Soon after that, my body began to feel better, even though I had a constant ringing in my ears and one knee would not bend all the time. Still, I walked by Mandenise's house every day to see if anything would change. Whenever there was more noise than usual on the roads, whenever people gathered in a group, I rushed out to see if it was the homecoming that would bring Mandenise out of her house. There were new arrivals all the time, people returning from the other side, people who were settling again in our quarter and in hers. Thinking of Sebastian's return made me wish for my hair to grow again, which it had not, for the inside of my ears to stop buzzing, for my knees to bend without pain, for my jaws to realign evenly, and for my smile that did not make me look like a feeding mule. At night, lying next to Eve, I grew more and more frightened that Sebastian would not recognize me if he ever saw me again.
33.
Eve spent all his days planting in his father's fields, then lingered with his friends and neighbors for late afternoon talk after his work. I never saw him but only heard him undress and slip into bed at night when he finally came home. A few weeks after his first planting, I waited for him to climb onto his side of the mattress and asked him, "Did anything come up from the ground for you?" Since we'd come back, we hadn't spoken of our situation, never even talked of changing it in a way that would make us both more comfortable at night.
"Only grass might come up this quick," he said. "And not every type of grass, even."
His scornful voice made me think that he was not a fortunate planter, or maybe he didn't think he was one. "I would like to go to the fields with you one day," I said.
"Why so?" he asked. "I want to see your father's land. It's no different than other land," he said.
I could hear him suddenly sitting up on the bed, as if in defense of what had just been said. I reached for his arms in the dark,
and pressed them down to show him that I truly wanted to be quietly grateful, to cooperate, to make the best out of our burden.
I hear there are officials of the state, justices of the peace, who listen to those who survived the slaughter and write their stories down, he said. The Generalissimo has not said that he caused the killing, but he agreed to give money to affected persons.
Why? I didn't think he would have the answer, but I wished he did know.
To erase bad feelings, he said, as if he were no longer linked to the slaughter.
And he did?
They pay their families, he said. I knew what he was thinking, that perhaps Mande Nice should go, in case Sebastian and Mimi were already dead. I stepped off the bed and crouched down in a corner of the room, as far from him as I could. I felt grateful that it was dark, that neither one of us could see the other's face.
I want to meet that justice of the peace myself, I said.
I don't know if you'll be given the money, he said. The authorities might try to keep it all for themselves. They ask you to bring papers. They ask you to bring proof.
But he knew that it was not money. It was information I was hoping for. The next morning we went to see the justice of the peace. He was posted in a yellow police building that seemed to have been shaped out of one massive mountain rock. Outside was a group of more than 1,000 people waiting to be allowed entry, a line of armed soldiers from the Gendarmerie Nationale stood between them and the narrow entrance to the building. As the morning went on, the waiting group became larger, so much so that when I pulled myself up and looked behind me, I could not see where the road ended and the faces began. Eve had not said a word the whole morning. He occasionally ventured off to get water or to help carry home some elder who had fainted from the heat. In the afternoon, food vendors arrived and people shared their tales, as if to practice for their real audience with the government official. The man next to me had walked 70 kilometers to avoid the crowds in his own town. Another woman had come from even farther away. Others were planning to go to Port-au-Prince, which fewer survivors had yet reached. There was only some vague order to the way people were allowed inside. The most mangled victims, the ones whose wounds had still not healed, were let in as soon as they arrived. Pregnant women entered quickly as well as those who could find some money to bribe the soldiers. To pass the time waiting, I thought of many ways to shorten my tale. Perhaps Eve and I would go in together and make both our stories one. That way, we would give someone else a chance to be heard. The justice of the peace came to the entrance at sundown. He was plainly dressed in a light green house shirt and pants, with a small watch on a gold chain dangling from his pants side pocket. In one hand was a large leather-covered notebook, and in the other, a shiny black case. His presence caused a stir in the crowd. The soldiers raised their rifles for silence so he could speak.
"I can do no more today," he said.
"No," moaned the crowd.
"And if I say one more, each of you will want to be that one," he said.
"No,"
the crowd disagreed.
"I will come tomorrow," he said.
"Tomorrow? Listen faster,"
someone recommended. The soldiers surrounded the justice of the peace as he went back inside. Then we saw his automobile speeding away from the protected yard behind the station. People rushed after him, but quickly gave up the chase, for many of them could not run far because of some injury or exhaustion from being in the sun all day. The last person who'd had an audience with him was a woman, 30 or 35 years old. She was dressed all in white, as though she were going off to a religious ceremony, and had a sun-bleached straw hat tied with a green ribbon under her chin.
What did they do for you in there?
Eve yelled out to her.
Others in the crowd joined in. Did they give you money?
She removed her hat and surveyed the faces staring up at her.
No, he did not give me money,
she said, watching the soldiers for approval.
You see the book he had with him?
She glanced at the guards once more, then turned her face back to the crowd.
He writes your name in the book, and he says he will take your story to President Stanley Vincent, so you can get your money.
She kept her eyes on the crowd, no longer watching the soldiers for approval.
Then he let you talk and let you cry, and he asks you if you have papers to show that all these people died.
The soldiers from the Police Nationale, wearing the same khaki uniforms as the Dominican soldiers, a common inheritance from their training during the Yankee invasion of the whole island, approached the woman from behind and asked her to move away from the entrance. The crowd protested with hisses. Two of the soldiers took her by the arms and carried her down the station steps. She tried to twist out of their hands. Finally, someone in the crowd pulled her from them for her own safety.
If you make trouble,
the sergeant, the station head, announced to the crowd, you will not be allowed to return tomorrow. The crowd dispersed slowly, perhaps wondering if there was any use in coming back the following day. Eve and I went back there for the next 15 days. New faces came and went. Some stopped coming. Some never left their places in front of the station, even when it rained. The justice of the peace came there every day, except Sundays. On the 16th day, we were waiting without hope in the back of the crowd when we saw her coming. I knew immediately who she was when Eve leaped from his place and headed for her.
Man, Denise, you came, he said.
I did come, yes,
she said in a voice sharp and abrupt like her daughter Mimi's. I want to stand here with all of you. She looked too young to be both Mimi and Sebastian's mother. She was long-legged and slender, her face the color of wet terracotta. She wore a long tan dress that swept the floor as she walked. Bowing her long neck, she greeted those people in the crowd she knew and merely nodded to the others. She glanced at me, but she did not see me. Instead, as she stood there, she watched the soldiers. Her eyes followed the movements of their rifles from shoulder to shoulder, their offhand leanings to talk to one another about offhand things. She kept stroking her side, reaching in and out of the deep recesses of her pockets for something too tiny to be held in her hand. At dusk, the justice of the peace did not come out to speak to the crowd. The head sergeant came out instead and announced that there would be no more testimonials taken. All the money had already been distributed. The justice of the peace had already gone away when no one was looking, knowing we would be enraged if we saw him depart. It took some time for people to take in what this meant. Their disappointment grew as the word spread from mouth to mouth and was reinterpreted by one person for the next. There were moans and screams of protests, convulsions and faintings as rocks began to fly. The people at the front of the crowd charged at the entrance. Trained by Yankee troops who were used to rebellious uprisings, the soldiers shot several rounds of bullets in the air. A few of the soldiers were caught and passed from hand to hand as blows were struck, but the crowd was not really interested in them. The group charged the station, looking for someone to write their names in a book and take their story to President Vincent. They wanted a civilian face to concede that what they had witnessed and lived through did truly happen. When they did not find such a person in sight, they freed the 10 male prisoners who were being held in the inner rooms and walked away with a few items the soldiers had left behind. 7 chairs, 6 canteens,
2 water jugs, 3 handkerchiefs, 14 coiled cowhide whips, 17 carinine tails, 2 sets of keys to the cells, and a giant official photograph of President Vincent. He was a sophisticated-looking man, President Stanislaw Vincent, with small spectacles worn very close to his eyes. He had a pair of beautifully large ears framing his moon face, a tiny dot of a mustache over pinched pensive lips. A poet's lips, it was said. In the photograph, he wore a gentleman's collar with a bow tie, the end of which touched the shiny medal of the Grand Cross of the Juan Pablo Duarte Order of Merit, given to him by the Generalissimo as a symbol of eternal friendship between our two peoples. The image of the Grand Cross caught the flames first when kerosene was brought, and the photo, then the police post, was set on fire, though only the wooden doors and the thin coat of paint on the building burned, for the concrete walls of the station did not even scorch. We dodged the rocks and torches and forced our way out of the crowd. Eve took Mandenise back to her house. Her neighbors who had heard about the melee came to console her. Soon her house was filled with her friends, the girls who ran errands for her, and some traveling vendors who paid to use her empty rooms as a night stop on their long journeys. The vendors set up mats and sheets in the two bare rooms, places Mimi and Sebastian must once have used. Mandenise had moved all their things into her own room to make it less empty, and also so that the vendors would not walk away with them, one of the errand girls explained. In the back of the house was Mandenise's room, containing a ring of old sealed-off oil drums filled with her own things as well as Mimi and Sebastian's effects. The vendors helped her climb on top of a pile of clothes on her bed. They wanted her to take off her tan dress and change into her nightdress, but she refused.
"Forgive me," she said,
excusing herself for the pile of clothes and the disorderliness of the oil drums in her room.
"What a difficult day this has been."
The neighbors offered her many cups of tea. She raised herself to take a sip from each, then buried her head in the pillow.
"Leave me," she said. "Please."
They left her, but we could all see from the crowded room opposite hers, since her room did not have a door. Eve returned to his mother's house that night, and I stayed at Mandenise's. After she fell asleep, I crept back inside and lay down at the foot of her bed. I heard her breath whistling, like someone who tried even in her sleep not to disturb others. When she woke up in the middle of the night to use her blue enameled chamber pot, she tripped and nearly fell on top of me. I moved the pot closer to her, and she climbed on it without questioning what I was doing there. The next morning before dawn, I went out and sat with the women vendors, who made themselves coffee before moving to the next station on their journey. As they drank their coffee, the women wondered out loud whether Mimi and Sebastian had disappeared forever in the country of death, as they called it, or if maybe things had returned to normal. Maybe everyone had returned to their everyday work, they hoped. While they were talking, I heard Mandenise call for water. I hurried inside, ahead of one of the girls who looked after her, picked up the earthen jar leaning against the wall, and handed her a cup of water. She was not fully awake when I held it to her lips. After taking a few sips, she pushed my hand away. The room had brightened a bit with the morning light. She narrowed her eyes as if trying to recognize me.
"Which one of them are you?"
she asked.
"Amabel," I said. "If you've come to pay for the night, put the money on one of the drums."
She said, "I have not come to pay," I said.
"What then?"
she asked. I put the earthen jar and the cup back against the wall.
I knew Mimi and Sebastian over there, I said. She sat up and reached for my ears, rolling my cheeks between her fingers as though my face belonged to her.
You knew my Micheline and my Sebastian, she said. My Mimi and Sebastian, you knew them?
Yes, I said. Her face broadened with a pained smile. She let go of me and clapped her hands together.
I didn't want my children to go and stay there forever, she said. Their father was killed in the hurricane. Sebastian had a cage full of pigeons that also died in the hurricane, and he was so sad. After the hurricane, this house was taken from us by the Yankees. They wanted to make a road of this house. It was given back to us only after they left. Because we had no house, my son went there first, and me, because I was weak in the lungs, I was to go live with my brother in Port-au-Prince. I had no money, so my daughter followed Sebastian, and they both sent me some. I came back from Port-au-Prince when the land was given back to us. But my children, maybe they didn't know that the Yankees left. Maybe they didn't know that the house was ours again. She fished in the pocket of her dress and pulled out 3 painted yellow coffee beans, the kind that Mimi and Sebastian's bracelets had been made of. I tapped them with the tip of my fingers and watched as they bounced against one another in her palm. These are mine, she said,
closing her hand around him, from my own bracelet, which broke long ago. I made 1 bracelet for each of my children and 1 for myself. But when I was anxious over the children, I tugged too hard at the bracelet and the thread broke. This is all I have left of the beads from my bracelet. I wanted her to let me touch the beads again. She reached into the pocket of her dress and laid them there.
Sit for a moment, she said.
I moved closer and sat on the edge of her bed.
So, you knew my Micheline? She asked.
I did.
She was always untamed for a young girl, she smiled. Her father gave her the name Micheline. Did she ever tell you this?
No, I said. She never did.
But Sebastian, you knew more about him. You knew him well.
Very well, I said. She smiled a knowing smile. Sebastian's smile, her cheeks ballooning, then caving down on the sides of her lips.
I named him Sebastian myself, she said, after the saint. You know of the Saint Sebastian, who died not once, but twice.
No, I didn't know.
The first time, soldiers shot arrows at his body and left him for dead. A widow found him and saw he was alive. The widow carried him to her house and treated his wounds. When he was healed, Saint Sebastian went back to the soldiers to show them the miracle of love that was his life. This time the soldiers beat him with sticks until he was truly dead.
She held her head between her hands, as though it were an unfamiliar thing, a load now too heavy for her. Reclining, she clutched the pillow under her head.
I named him Sebastian, she said, because I knew it would be wise if a man could have 2 deaths. The first one comes quick enough. So it's good to have another one in reserve.
I moved towards her and adjusted the pillow beneath her head. I pressed my palm down on her forehead as she looked up, staring directly into my eyes. I could tell that she trusted something about me, even though she herself might not have known what it was.
A young man came here to see me some days past.
She reached up and pressed down hard on my hand as it was resting on her forehead.
He came here to see me on his way to Port-au-Prince.
He said he sold my children killed in a courtyard between two government edifices there, in a place he called Santiago. He said he saw them herd my children with a group, make them lie face down on the ground, and shoot them with rifles. I felt my fingers stick to her forehead as she pressed down harder on my hand. Her body was shaking, but she was not crying. In my place, would you believe this? She asked. No, I would not believe this, I said. But in my heart I kept thinking, how could I not? Wouldn't Sebastian have come home already if he was still alive?
You knew my Micheline. You knew my Sebastian. Do you believe it for yourself?
She insisted. No, I do not believe it for myself, I said. But I did. I believed it because what I had seen in Dajabón, because of what I had heard of La Romana, because of what the people said in the clinic that day about those who'd died in Santiago.
Leave me, please,
she said, releasing my hand. I wish to stay, I said.
Leave me.
As I was going, she stopped me in the doorway and asked, did you ever see my children wearing these bracelets I made for them? They were never without them, I said.
This is what they say, the people who come here to bring the word to me. It is not just one traveler, but many. They say that my children died with my bracelets on their wrists.
Pushing her hand inside her pocket, she pressed the beads against the side of her thigh.
Those who die young, they are cheated, she said. Not cheated out of life, because life is a penance. But the young, they're cheated because they don't know it's coming. They don't have time to move closer, to return home. When you know you're going to die, you try to be near the bones of your own people. You don't even think you have bones when you're young. Even when you break them, you don't believe you have them. But when you're old, they start reminding you they're there. They start turning to dust on you, even as you're walking here and there, going from place to place. And this is when you crave to be near the bones of your own people. My children never felt this. They had to look death in the face, even before they knew what it was. Just like you did, no? I nodded yes, mostly because I knew she wanted me to. I wish people would stop coming to tell me they saw my children die, she said.
I wish I had my hopes that they were living someplace, even if they never did come back to see me again. Maybe those who came with the word, maybe they are mistaken. They are always strangers, the people who come, she said. They do not know me. Before they died, either alone or together, my son and daughter told them to come here and tell me about their fates. She pushed her hands into her pocket and pressed them down on the beads. Leave me now, she said. I'm going to dream up my children. I strolled like a ghost through the walking life of the cap, wondering whenever I saw people with deformities, anything from a broken nose to crippled legs, had they been there? I followed the road from Ma Denise's house, out to the quay, where ships entered the harbor with horns blaring while others were being unloaded as they wobbled against the piers. The sacks of rice, beans, and sugar were being distributed among the merchants as a line of bare-chested young men waited with wheelbarrows to carry the stacks off for them. These men, with more than the weight of their bodies and sugar on their heads, shouted in an uneven chorus of rage in order to be allowed to pass
through the streets.
34.
When I went back to Eve's house, he had already left for the fields. I sat in the yard with my arms around the traveler's tree, trying not to pound my head against it. Ma Rapadu came out to the courtyard in her nightdress, smiling. She carried a low chair from her room and sat down next to me.
"You don't need the justice of the peace," she said. "You don't need a confessor. I, Man Rapadu, I know your tale."
She pressed her face close to mine and whispered so the others in the courtyard couldn't hear.
"I asked my son why there is no love between you and him, and he told me about Sebastian."
As I watched her flawless smile grow wider on her face, which should have been a lot sadder than it was, I stroked the traveler's tree. Not sure what else to do with my hands, I reached up and touched the frilled yellow-green palmetto branches. The narrow stems had woven themselves together like the inside of an enormous wicker basket. I wanted to cry, but I couldn't. I wanted to scream, but summoning the will to do it already made me feel weak. "When my son left here, I planted this traveler's tree. And now look how it's grown," Man Rapadu said. "Eve told me you can make dresses and help give birth to children. Since I'm not to have children anymore, maybe you can make me a dress." Kindness prevailed on Man Rapadu to let me spend the rest of the day inside, and her son's bed by myself. She did not call me to eat, even when the mid-afternoon meal was ready. Instead, she whispered from outside the door that she was saving a plate of food for me to have whenever my stomach felt at ample ease. As I lay in bed with my arms and legs coiled around myself, I ached inside in places I could neither name nor touch. I could not accept that I'd never see Sebastian again, even though I knew it was possible, just as I would never see my mother and father again, no matter how many times I called them forth, both with my own loud voice and the timid one inside my head. When it came to my parents, the older I became, the more they were fading from me, until all I could see were the last few moments spent with them by the river. The rest blended together like the ingredients in a too-long simmered stew. Reveries and dreams, wishes, fantasies. Is that what it would also come to with Sebastian? I feigned sleep when Eve came to bed that night. But unlike the other times, he was not convinced by my frozen pose.
"My beans have sprouted," he announced. "Looks like I'll see a harvest."
I did not want to move. Perhaps he didn't know about Mimi and Sebastian, and I wasn't certain how to tell him.
"I hear," he said, "that the priests at the cathedral listen and mark down testimonials of the slaughter."
This was his gift to me, like the gift the earth had given him in pushing his beans back up in a different form.
"They don't promise you money."
His voice staggered between high and low, as though he were beginning to think that I might really be asleep.
"They're collecting tales for newspapers and radio men. The Generalissimo has found ways to buy and sell the ones here. Even this region has been corrupted with his money."
I turned on my back, opened my eyes, and tried to find the silvery lines of rusting tin on the ceiling.
"Will you go yourself to see these priests?" I asked. "I know what will happen," he said. "You tell the story, and then it's retold as they wish, written in words you do not understand, in a language that is theirs and not yours.
Will you go?"
"I have already gone, and they looked in their books. Their names are not there.
There are good days now, waiting for me in the fields. This means we will start to have money. You can buy cloth and thread, sew for people, and make money on your own.
At that moment, the future seemed a lot more frightening than the past. Perhaps working the earth, making beans sprout out of dry, hard seeds and dust, could make him believe that he had forgotten. But I couldn't trust time or money to make me forget. Sometimes I conjured up the group from the border clinic, especially Nunun's man, who had woken up in the cadaver pit, and the woman with the large appetite and the rope burns on her neck. I imagined them going forward in their lives, cultivating their gardens, taking their animals to the stream, skipping out of the road to avoid speeding trucks, calling their children in for an evening wash, making love to the people they'd been reunited with. I wanted to bring them out of my visions into my life, to tell them how glad I was that they had been able to walk into their future. But most important, to ask them how it was that they could be so strong, what their secret was, how they could wash their lives clean, if only for brief moments, from the past. "How did you keep on with the planting, even when nothing was growing?" I asked Eve. I could hear him breathing loudly, tapping his tongue against the roof of his mouth, trying to find the right phrasing for his answer.
"Empty houses and empty fields make me sad," he said. "They are both too calm, like the dead season."
He pushed his body down, farther into the mattress, as though our speaking together had made him feel like he was more entitled to do so. After a long silence, he added,
"The night when Joel was hit by the automobile, it was almost me who died."
"I think Sebastian felt like this too,"
I said.
"No, no,"
he said. "Joel, Sebastian and me, we were walking down the road together. Joel was in the middle, and Sebastian and me, we were on either side of him. I was on the side closest to the road. We saw the light and heard the automobile in the same instant. By the time we turned around, it was almost on my neck."
Joel pushed me aside, so he had no time to run himself. He was struck and thrown into the ravine.
I listened for signs that Ma Rapadu was in a deep sleep in the next room, her loud snoring and occasional shifts on the bed.
"Then the automobile stopped, and the people came out," he said. "I didn't see Sebastian. I didn't know where he was. I thought he was hit too. I ran off to hide behind a tree in the dark. The old man wanted to stay and look for us, but the other one, the son-in-law, was in a great haste.
I wanted to tell him that he was right to run, brave even, that perhaps it was Joel's day to die, that there might have even been a worse death waiting for Joel in the slaughter. I wanted to say most of those things that never comfort the person hearing them, but only the one saying them.
It could have been me too at the church with Mimi and Sebastian, if I hadn't gone to sell the wood," he continued. "Yes, I saw them put Sebastian and Mimi and all the others on a truck. I saw it all from the road. They made them stand in groups of six and then forced them to climb. The priests asked to stay with the people, but they took the priests separately. And then they took the doctor and the people together. If he wanted to be a Haitien, they told Dr. Javier, they would treat him like a Haitien. I saw Mimi climb when her turn came. Sebastian was in line behind her. Her knee